From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Terry Gross is out with the flu today, but we have a couple of her interviews. First, Terry talks with actor Anthony Hopkins. He played the brilliant killer Hannibal Lecter in the movie The Silence of the Lambs. Also today, we hear a proposal for peace in the Mideast from Israeli scholar Mark Heller and Palestinian scholar Sari Nasebeh. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a documentary you should be sure to catch and a miniseries you should be sure to miss. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas met this afternoon with President Bush. Thomas said he would just testify when asked by reporters if he'd be able to refute Anita Hill's accusations. Today's meeting is the first between Mr. Bush and Thomas since the sexual harassment charges were first aired publicly. The confirmation vote has been put off until next Tuesday. Senator Joseph Biden, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said today the FBI would be called to investigate and witnesses would be subpoenaed if necessary for a hearing that's most likely to be scheduled for Friday. A ceasefire is holding in Yugoslavia following exhaustive talks by representatives of the Yugoslav and Croatian armies. An agreement was reached in Zagreb. Pierre Vickery reports the pact is an important breakthrough in resolving the civil war in Croatia.
The Dutch head of the European Community ceasefire mission, Ambassador Dirk van Houten, said the agreement held out better prospects for peace than the many earlier negotiated ceasefires. There's to be an immediate lifting of all land and sea blockades on the Adriatic coast, and the withdrawal of Yugoslav army troops from the region, together with all their military hardware. Additionally, the huge federal garrison at Borongaj in Zagreb is to be vacated no later than Sunday. Daily talks between representatives of the two armies will continue to deal with the future of all other Yugoslav army military facilities in the now independent Republic of Croatia. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A ceasefire between Iran and ethnic Kurdish rebels doesn't appear to be faring as well. Reports say Iraqi forces shelled a number of Kurdish towns about 100 miles northeast of Baghdad. Jewish settlers have evacuated several houses in East Jerusalem, which they say they've purchased. Palestinians argue the houses belong to them. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
About 26 families moved into five houses in the Palestinian village of Silwan in Arab East Jerusalem before dawn this morning. They say they either purchased or were granted the rights to all of the homes from the Israeli housing corporation Amidar. Early this morning, four members of the Israeli Knesset or parliament joined the group. Police removed the settlers from three of the houses but allowed them to stay in two. One of these two had been inhabited by a Palestinian family of seven until yesterday. After day-long negotiations, the settlers agreed to leave one of the houses, but the Knesset members will stay in the second until the court decides the question of ownership. Watchmen from Amidar will patrol the empty buildings, and more than 100 police were assigned to guard the four Knesset members. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 17 points at 2946.78. Trading's active in 179 million shares. This is NPR News. Despite what it says are many unanswered questions about long-term safety and effectiveness, the Food and Drug Administration today approved a second AIDS drug. The new drug, DDI, was approved to treat patients at advanced stages of infection and who don't respond to or can't tolerate AZT, the only other fully approved anti-AIDS drug. Both drugs function similarly to slow progression of AIDS, but neither cures the disease. The U.S. came in for criticism in a report issued today by the human rights organization Amnesty International. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
The Amnesty report claims that more than 90 people who were aged between 15 and 17 at the time of their crime had been sentenced to death since the 1970s. Four have been executed since 1985. The most recent execution was in Louisiana in 1990 when 30-year-old Dalton Prejean was electrocuted for a murder committed when he was 17. Amnesty International's Anita Thiessen says that's unacceptable.
It's something that is flying in the face of growing international trends, growing international movement towards abolition of the death penalty in general, and is, as far as we're concerned, a real retrograde step for human rights.
The Amnesty report notes that only Iran and Iraq put more juvenile defenders to death than the United States. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
General Colin Powell, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is rejecting calls for deeper cuts in U.S. military forces. In a speech to a private group in Washington, Powell said he would resist demands that the end of the Cold War produce a larger peace dividend. Powell also appeared to reject a proposal by Soviet President Gorbachev to withdraw nuclear bombs carried aboard U.S. and Soviet warplanes. The government has charged the maker of Glad trash bags with failing to adequately substantiate claims that the bags will decompose when thrown away. I'm Doreen McAllister, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's home today nursing a little bug. So we turn to our archives. Earlier this year, movie audiences took to a psychopathic anti-hero in Jonathan Demme's film The Silence of the Lambs. Dr. Hannibal, the cannibal Lecter, is a brilliant psychiatrist who is also a demented killer. Demented enough to eat his victims, and effete enough to wash them down with a carefully selected glass of Chianti. This chilling and perverse performance was created by actor Anthony Hopkins. Hopkins also played the humane doctor in David Lynch's film The Elephant Man. Terry spoke with Anthony Hopkins when The Silence of the Lambs opened in theaters. Soon you'll be able to see his creepy portrayal of Hannibal Lecter at home. The video version will be out later this month. In The Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster plays an FBI investigator who visits Lecter in prison, hoping his brilliant criminal mind will reveal clues to help her track down another serial killer known as Buffalo Bill.
I'm offering you a psychological profile of Buffalo Bill based on the case evidence. I'll help you catch him, Terry.
You know who he is, don't you? Tell me who decapitated your patient, Doctor.
All good things to those who wait. I've waited, Clarice, but how long can you and old Jackie boy wait? Our little Billy must already be searching for that next special lady.
Anthony Hopkins told Terry how he came up with the voice for Hannibal Lecter.
When I was assured that the part was on offer to me, I started to work on it and simply to learn the lines and think about it. And it was such a well-written part, and the story was so compelling, that when I, after the first reading, I heard the voice of Hannibal Lecter. It sort of, I heard it in my head, I saw a vision of it, I saw what he looked like. Well, not strictly within the first reading, but let's say maybe two or three readings of the script. Because my work is kind of quite simple. I just learn it, you know, before I start filming. Just learn the text, learn the words. And the voice came. And for some reason, I don't know why, the voice, in fact, identified the character for me, and I saw within a few more days what he looked like, the hair being slicked back and the way he moved, his grace and elegance.
Describe what you did with your voice.
Well, it was there was one line which I think you've seen on the trailers, and I said, I'll help you catch him, Clarice. I didn't know what it was. It was just a kind of tone, and there's a speech where he says, one of the speeches that made me understand man was, he said, you know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube, a well-scrubbed hustling rube with a little taste. And I thought, that's it, that's the character.
You know, there's something both very effete, very scary, and very purring about the voice.
Yes.
Well,
the thing is, if you're playing an evil character, if you're playing somebody who's mad or evil,
mm-hmm.
Well, let's say, just take the first part. If you're playing somebody who's mad, the thing is not to play him mad, but to play the opposite, play him as ultra sane. If you're playing somebody who's evil, play the good side of him, and that makes him more scary, because you humanize him. Of course, nobody is all evil, nobody's all good. whatever those terms mean, but nobody is all one thing. So what I do as an actor is to find out what the other side of the character is. And I found out with Lecter that, in fact, I think his problem is, or his peculiar psychology is, that he is so in control of himself, mentally, spiritually, physically, whichever way, he's so totally in control of every aspect of his thinking that he is completely mad, because nobody can be in that much control. It's as if he is so sane, he's flipped over into the world of the dark and the irrational.
Now, I don't know if this is connected to the control you see the characters having, but you rarely blink in the movie. I mean, the eyes have a fixed stare and they're wide open all the time.
Yes. Well, I don't know. I didn't analyze much about the part. I mean, I just had a hunch on how to play him. First of all, when you're playing a character like this, you have to like him. The actor has to somehow like him. And I think there's something very terrifying about people who are unblinking. It's that they are so certain. They have no doubts, no uncertainty. And they're so certain that makes them terrifying. If you look at all the great monstrous political leaders in our century, you know.
One of which you've played.
Yes. Yes. Old Adolf, yes. They rise to power because they're so certain, they have no doubts. Their minds are already made up. Somebody said of Hitler, a journalist who interviewed Hitler in 1936, before the war, she said, Hitler has in his library 1,000 books. He hasn't read any one of them. But of course he doesn't need to, because his mind is already made up. And I found that the most apocalyptic, frightening vision of a man. And I think it's the same with Lecter. He knows with absolute certainty what he is and what everyone else is around him.
What kind of kidding took place on the set in between shooting?
We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of laughs on the set. I go up behind people. There'd be people working on the women working on the props or something, or, you know, some of the guys walked around. I got behind them and said, good evening. Are you having pleasant dreams? And they'd sort of jump because they got used to this character I was playing. And I, at the end of the day shooting, you know, they get into the elevator and I creep in afterwards. I say, I got you all in my elevator. So they used to sort of freak out, but not seriously, but it was a joke. It was a kind of funny joke. Everyone on the set was very happy. I mean, everyone seemed to work very, with a great deal of ease.
You said that you really liked working with Jonathan Demme. Is there any kind of direction that he gave you that is different from what you're used to getting? Is there something different about the style that he works in?
I think the great hallmark, for me anyway, of the great sort of positive for me, is when directors, it's not that they exactly leave you alone, but what they do, they let you develop the character. And it's really a question of trust. And what I felt with Jonathan was that he had total trust in me as an actor. And because he paid me that compliment, I had total trust in him as a director. And I'd seen some of his films. I'd seen Something Wild, Married to the Mob. And I thought I knew that I was in the hands of a very skilled craftsman. He would listen to some of my suggestions that I wanted to do. And, you know, he asked me, he said, how do you feel about, how would you like to first be seen, you know, when the film spends a lot of time talking about Lecter before they see him. And I said, well, if you don't mind, I said, I'd like to just be seen standing right in the middle of the cell, as if I'm waiting for her. And he said, God, that's weird. He said, well, I said, well, it's the most terrifying thing I can think of, is the very monster that she's listened to and heard about. When she actually goes towards him and she comes into eye contact, comes into the area of his cell, that he is staring straight at her with a nice smile on his face. And I sensed in my own psyche, whatever that means, that that's the most terrifying thing. That's the sort of base of my nightmares, in a way. Or it was as a child.
Somebody waiting for you?
Somebody waiting for me in the corner, in the top of the stairs. Or I used to have a dream. I'd open the door. When I was a child, there'd be banging on the front door of the house in the dark, and it was always moonlight. And as I opened the door, there'd be nobody there, but across the street, in a window, three floors up in the building opposite, there was a face staring out at me and smiling. That was the most terrifying nightmare. In itself, it doesn't sound frightening, but there's something strange about that. And this is what I wanted to do to the audience. I wanted them to just take that moment of horror when they see Lecter, that they don't see somebody with blood dripping off his mouth. They see a very pleasant, normal-looking man standing to attention in the middle of his hour. Very weird.
Actor Anthony Hopkins speaking with Terry Gross. He played Dr. Hannibal, the cannibal Lecter, in Jonathan Demme's film The Silence of the Lambs, which will be out on home video later this month. His other roles have included the psychiatrist in the theatrical production of Equus and the compassionate doctor in David Lynch's film The Elephant Man. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with actor Anthony Hopkins.
You know, it's interesting. You've worked with the two most offbeat, stylish the younger directors, Jonathan Demme and David Lynch. And they're maybe the two most idiosyncratic in the kinds of movies that they make. And I think it's interesting that you, a British actor coming from the National Theatre, you know, from a more classic theatre, has ended up working with them.
Well, I mean, I've been trying for years to break away from that image of the British National Theatre. I mean, I've worked there, and I've enjoyed myself. I've had a good time there, but it's something I've been predominantly interested in films, and especially American movies. I've always been a fan of American films ever since I was a kid. So working with somebody like Lynch or Demme is always an experience. I mean, David Lynch and Demme are, I think, I don't know, I haven't seen David for 10 years, 12 years, or whatever it's been. But I think they're two opposites in a way. I mean, they're both quirky, they're both idiosyncratic. But I can recall David's methods were probably different to Jonathan's. Jonathan seemed to be very precise. He knew what he wanted immediately, I think. David was living in another world. He had a sort of an inner film going on in his own mind anyway, and he saw visions and images that he wanted. And I remember, actually, I regret it now, but I was rather, I used to feel kind of irritated because I didn't know what he wanted. But watching his movies since, like Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart, I see, you know, that the man's got, you know, he's got such a powerful image in his own mind, but he has his own way of translating it.
Well, let me ask you this. When you were doing that scene where you see the Elephant Man for the first time, and of course, In real life, you weren't looking at anything, you know, because John Hurt wasn't made up yet. Did you use sense memory or anything to get involved with an emotion from your past that would make you feel the way the character is supposed to be feeling? Do you do that?
No, I remember that morning. What I do remember very clearly was that I was feeling... I'd been hanging around for days, actually, and I was feeling particularly vulnerable. And I suppose a bit depressed. I don't know what it was about. I can't remember. And I remembered I fixed my eye on a spot on the wall, and for some reason, I can't understand it to this day what happened, but the 23rd Psalm, which is used by John Hurt in the film, in fact, but the 23rd Psalm came into my mind. Now, I don't know why. I hadn't remembered it since I'd been in school, and for some reason, it came into my mind, and I remember the overpowering impressions when I was a child in school of green hills and valleys and lakes, which were around my hometown when I was a child, and the woods and the forests and the valley and all that. And it was a very strange sensation. There was a chalk spot on the wall opposite me. I fixed my eye on that, and this inner voice, it was my own voice, but it was like a memory, like a kind of recitation of, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, he maketh me..." And it must have had the right emotional reaction, because that's what happened. I don't understand it, and I'm glad David Lynch didn't ask me to do it again, because I probably wouldn't have been able to repeat it. Because those things happen once in a while, you know, and you can't really rely upon them. They happen or they don't happen. And if they don't happen, you have to do it purely technical.
You know, both of the movies that we've been talking about, Silence of the Lambs and The Elephant Man, you, in both of them you play very educated people. And I'm wondering what kind of education you had yourself.
Well, I was hopeless at school. I was a non-starter. When I was at school, 4 years of age, I didn't understand what the teachers were talking about. I was way behind everyone else. And looking back on it, I suppose that's why I became an actor. A lot of actors I know, there are exceptions to the rule. I know some actors who are very, very clever and went to university and college and all that. But I was one of the, I was one of those who just didn't know what time of day it was. I was living in another world, except I didn't know what world that was that I was inhabiting. So as I started growing up, I became quite a mimic, because I suppose this was my way of coping and a sense of belonging by being able to imitate authority like schoolmasters and, you know. But as a student, I was hopeless. I guess I was what they call slow or backward. I certainly wasn't very swift academically, so when I get to play these intelligent parts now and these very erudite men, I have to laugh or smile to myself, because that's the last thing I am, is erudite. I mean, I've sort of educated myself over the years. You know, I read a lot. I read quite a lot, and I've tried to reform my education.
You know, I've seen several articles in which you've been compared to Richard Burton, who, like you, is from Wales. Is that why you're compared, because you're both from the same place?
Well, we're from the same town.
So did he have, like, significance to you when you were coming of age wanting to act?
Yes, he represented to me freedom, because I couldn't function in school. I mean, I'm making it sound terrible, actually. I mean, it wasn't that bad, but I mean, I was a bit lonely, you know. I just wanted to get out of where I was, because it didn't seem I had much future. I had no qualifications from school. What could I be? So Burton represented to me glamour, freedom, and all that. And the only time I met him was when I went to ask him for his autograph when I was about 15 years of age, and I remember thinking, when I left his house, he'd signed my autograph book. I thought, God, I wish I could be like that, you know, I wish I could be him, or I wish I could be famous or something like that. And it was the rocket fuel, I guess, or that resentment or anger, or whatever it was, that drove me on. And ironically, the strange thing was, as fate will have it, I next met Richard Burton in the dressing room in New York in the Plymouth Theatre. I'd started the play Equus in New York in 1974, and Richard Burton took over in 1976. So it was a very strange twist of fate, and that's the second and last time I met him.
Another one of those highly educated parts, I'll point out.
Yes, it was. It
You're
was.
Playing the psychiatrist.
Yes. It was extraordinary meeting Richard in those days, because they are sitting in the same dressing room. He said, "Why haven't we ever worked before? Why haven't we ever worked together?" And he said, "We come from the same town." I said, "Yeah." He said, "My God, this is weird." But sadly, I never worked with him. It's a great loss that he died.
Actor Anthony Hopkins is my guest. Now, you early on in your career, you performed at the National Theater, the theater company founded by Laurence Olivier. He was there for the audition?
Yes, I was interviewed by him, and he auditioned me. And he was playing Othello at the time. And I'd been called in to do this audition for him, and I didn't know any other Shakespeare, you know, not being the most erudite actor in the world, but the only piece I knew was from Othello. And Olivia just opened in a resounding success in the National Theatre. This has gone back almost, 25 years, 20, whatever it is, 27 years ago. And he asked me, he said, what audition piece are you going to do? I said, Othello. He said, "You've got a nerve, haven't you?" said. And, Anyway, I did the piece, and he took me in and asked me to join the company. And we became, he was a different generation. He was a much older man than me, than myself. But we became friends, you know, and I got to know him over the years. We didn't become close friends, because there's a huge generation gap. But he took me under his wing. I was one of his favorite actors. I think I was his favorite because I was very rebellious. I was a bit of a troublemaker. And I think secretly, he sort of admired that. I mean, he was a great disciplinarian. You know, he didn't like people causing trouble. But But in a way, if you were troublesome, he respected that in a way. It made him smile, I think.
What kind of trouble did you cause at the National Theatre?
Well, I used to go and demand work. I said, give me a part. And they said, well, you've only just joined the company. I said, I don't give a damn. I said, I'll go back and work in rep. I said, give me a part. You know, I'm going to have to stand around carrying spears for the rest of my life. And he got to hear about this, and he said, you're very feisty at your heart, you know, dear boy. And anyway, he gave me some good breaks and good chances, and I was very, very pugnacious, very arrogant, very aggressive. And looking back, I'm glad I was. I've had to sort of jettison a lot of that as the years have gone by, because it's finally it's something, it's a kind of ballast that you no longer need as you get older, I think. So I'm much more at ease with myself now, and not so feisty.
What would you call Olivier when you worked with him and knew him?
Larry.
Not Sir Larry or anything?
No, he there was a time when he gave you permission. He said you'd call him Sir, you know. He'd say, you can call me Larry. So you call him Larry. It's always a great privilege then. But I got to know him over the years, and he was a very funny man. He was an extraordinary man. A great, great actor. The greatest sort of theatrical talent of his age, I think. The people say, you know, who's the next Olivier? I don't think there's anyone will ever. There is no one who will touch him.
I want to thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Pleasant dreams.
Actor Anthony Hopkins speaking with Terry Gross. The Silence of the Lambs will be released later this month on home video. Hopkins also had a starring role in David Lynch's 1980 film, The Elephant Man. Here's the theme from The Elephant Man soundtrack, written by composer John Morris. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Terry Gross felt fine yesterday. Today she feels not so great, so I'm filling in for her. Mark Heller is an Israeli scholar and a Jew. Sara Nesebe is a Palestinian scholar and an Arab. Together, the two spent months debating about how to achieve peace in the Mideast, and they think they've come up with a solution. Yesterday, Terry Gross interviewed them about their proposal. Coming up, we'll hear that interview. Also, we hear from TV critic David Bianculli. He has reviews of A Woman Named Jackie, a new miniseries about Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and a new documentary about the making of the movie Apocalypse Now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. The House Ethics Committee met in closed session today to begin its review of lawmakers who regularly wrote bad checks without penalty at the House bank, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The committee is investigating a GAO report that more than 100 members wrote 8,331 checks with insufficient funds in the last 12 months. The House voted last week to close down the bank and refer the matter to the Ethics Committee. Most of the bad checks are small, but there are a few dozen members who wrote bad checks of $1,000 or more on a regular basis. The Ethics Committee will have to determine if members who repeatedly wrote bad checks abused their banking privileges, and in so doing brought discredit on the House. The committee will also review the general operation and management of the House Bank by the Sergeant at Arms Office. The Ethics Committee will have a new temporary chairman for the investigation. Matthew McHugh of New York took over from Committee Chairman Lewis Stokes of Ohio after Stokes announced he wouldn't participate because he, too, wrote bad checks at the bank. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The White House says President Bush remained steadfast behind Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. A spokesman, Marlon Fitzwater, says the administration will give him every bit of support possible and work as hard as possible to see he's confirmed. The Senate has voted to delay the confirmation vote a week to take a new look at sexual harassment claims made by a former aide, Anita Hill. The White House has lodged a formal protest with the Israeli government concerning flights by Israeli warplanes over Iraq. The violations occurred Friday when four jets carried out an apparent reconnaissance mission over newly discovered Scud missile launchers in western Iraq. Some 40 Scuds fell on Israel during the Gulf War. More from the BBC's Alex Brody in Jerusalem.
The American protest resulted from American anger at the insensitivity, at the very least, of Israeli planes flying into Iraq at a most delicate time. United Nations teams are there trying to find and destroy its weaponry of mass destruction in the teeth of Iraqi obduracy, as seen by the standoff between the nuclear inspectors and Iraqi troops and the attempt to deny UN helicopters free movement. Also, the Americans are concerned because the American Secretary of State, James Baker, is about to make his final push to realize the Arab-Israeli peace conference. For according to Israel Radio, Israeli planes also violated the airspace of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Syria in getting to and from Iraq. The Israeli Defense Ministry has refused to confirm or deny the American allegations.
The BBC's Alex Brody. The ceasefire in the secessionist Yugoslav Republic of Croatia appears to be holding. The pact reached last night is the seventh aimed at ending the fighting. On Wall Street, stocks closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials fell just under 17.5 points. This is National Public Radio News. The International Monetary Fund is predicting that after the slowest annual growth in nearly a decade, the world economy will rebound modestly next year as the U.S. recovers from its recession. But in its annual World Outlook report released today, the group says there's nothing but uncertainty for the crumbling Soviet economy. California has a new law opening the financial records of savings and loans to all shareholders. It's trying to prevent the fraud that led to the recent SNL crisis. More from Harry Lynn of member station KQED in San Francisco.
The new law will require savings and loan associations in California to open their financial records, books of account, register of stockholders, and minutes of board meetings to shareholders or a group of shareholders holding 1% of the shares. Currently, state laws shield California's SNLs from releasing investment information by limiting access to that information to a small minority of shareholders. Also, any shareholder seeking such information must submit a written request to the state commissioner for approval. The new law addresses that last requirement by suspending the commissioner's right of approval. Critics of the national SNL failure say a lack of information among all shareholders greatly contributed to the crisis. They hope the new law will reduce fraud within the industry. The law is set to take effect at the beginning of 1992. For National Public Radio, I'm Harry Lynn in San Francisco.
The chicken processing plant in Hamlet, North Carolina, where a fire killed 25 people last month, will not reopen. Employees at the plant, which is the town's biggest employer, have received letters telling them the plant will remain shut down. In the letter, the company's president said the plant's closing was prompted in part by the fire and by the company's inability to make arrangements for financing. The Organization of American States is preparing to send a civilian mission to help Haiti facilitate the return of democratic rule. I'm Doreen McAllister, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out sick today. I'm Marty Moscowain. Secretary of State James Baker is furiously trying to get a Middle East peace conference started in the next few weeks. Just organizing the conference has at times seemed impossible. So actually solving the problems in the Middle East often seems truly hopeless. But the Foundation for Middle East Peace decided to go ahead and try to come up with a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They brought together a Palestinian and an Israeli to hammer out a detailed plan. The Palestinian, Sara Nesebe, is a leading activist and a university lecturer in philosophy. The Israeli, Mark Heller, is the author of A Palestinian State, The Implications for Israel. They've published the details of their plan for a two-state solution in the new book, No Trumpets, No Drums. Heller and Nesebe both admit that their plan is not an ideal solution, but is the least undesirable choice. It calls for two separate nations with a boundary that roughly adheres to the 1949 borders, with a Palestinian state located in the West Bank and Gaza. The two men felt that if they couldn't agree on a plan, then how could all of the Israelis and all of the Palestinians ever find a workable solution? They were able to agree on a proposal and even became friends during the process, but it wasn't easy. They had many different views and interests. Sara Nesebe told Terry Gross that one of the hardest questions for him was who has more of a right to the land.
As far as I was concerned, you know, as a person who was born there and who grew up there, who has had family roots extending back hundreds of years in Jerusalem, it was very difficult for me to accept having to negotiate over part of this country with someone who was basically somebody who had made aliyah to Israel from Canada. Now, you know, but this is one level, and I understand, of course, that on another level or on other levels, you know, how strongly Jews would feel in any case associated with that country. So I don't have a problem, as it were, understanding that on that level, that kind of association. It was a personal problem, and it's always been, actually, and it probably will continue to be. I mean, even today, when I think about people coming over, say, from the Soviet Union, or how easy for them to do so, to come as immigrants from the Soviet Union to Israel, and compare that with how difficult it is for Palestinians who somehow or another seem to be, in my mind anyway, more deeply, genuinely, realistically rooted in the country. It's very difficult to reconcile the two ideas or the two forms.
Mark Heller, did you realize that Sara Nesebe was going through this kind of thought about you and about the different claims that people have on the land? And I wonder what your reaction is to what he just said.
Well, I suppose in the course of doing the work and of getting to know each other, each of us became a little better informed or a little more sensitive to the concerns of the other one. I, for my part, also felt some difficulty coming to grips with the idea that I was being required in order to promote some kind of political settlement, to negotiate basically about what are unilateral concessions as far as territory is concerned. That in the give and take, all of the giving on territory would be done by one side and all of the taking would be done by the other side. I don't think it's realistic for people to proceed from the assumption that they're going to be more sensitive to the other side's concerns than they are to their own. I don't think there's any possibility of making any practical progress. The only way to make any progress is if people explore whether or not they can accommodate the other side's concerns with their own, which is, after all, what they're primarily concerned about.
You're saying that empathizing with what Sari Nusseibeh just said wasn't important in the process for you?
No, on the contrary, I'm saying that it's very important to empathize with the concerns of the other side and the need to try to accommodate the concerns of the other side, but within the context of making sure that your own basic needs and requirements are met. Now, in this particular instance, on the issue that was just raised, the basic need, historic need and requirement of the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years has been to have a safe homeland of their own, for which they are not dependent on the goodwill or the mercy of anyone else. And that is the basic fundamental objective of the Jewish state, is to provide an asylum, particularly for Jews in need.
Now,
I just say something here?
Yeah,
I just wanted to say that, you know, from my point of view, really, as a Palestinian, I don't think that I'm interested as such in the other side, for instance, Mark or anybody empathizing with me or feeling sympathy or understanding. And I don't think that it's necessary. I think what's more important, really, and what I found interesting about our joint venture this time was that we proceeded from calculations that were based on perceived self-interest. In other words, you know, Mark was proceeding from the basis that he was trying to fulfill in doing what he was doing, the interests as he saw them of Israel. And, you know, I think that's what's important. And as long as in doing that, he therefore achieves or reaches the point where he feels that he can therefore accommodate Palestinian aspirations within a certain context, an acceptable context, I think that's what's important.
Mark Heller, many Israelis and many Jews in the United States see the two-state solution as ultimately a threat to Israel's security. You're offering that solution as something that would secure, that would help Israel be more secure in the future. Why do you see a Palestinian state as helping to make Israel more secure instead of less secure?
Well, I think it's important to qualify the proposition. It's not so much a question of a Palestinian state per se as helping to secure Israel's future, but rather the context in which it is created, which is to say a comprehensive political settlement of all of the outstanding issues in the Arab-Israeli conflict, with appropriate security guarantees in case one or another of those provisions should break down. But at least it creates the possibility for fundamental transformation in Israel's relations with its neighbors in the area, and I would suggest with the rest of the world as well. I think that as long as this albatross hangs around Israel's neck, the albatross being the conflict in general and the Palestinian dimension of it in particular, it will be virtually impossible to secure the economic prosperity and the technological process and the investment in education and infrastructure and the resources needed for the absorption of immigrants and the entrenchment of Israeli democratic values that are necessary to secure the kind of Israel that's important to me.
Of course, a two-state settlement means that Palestinians would have to recognize Israel's right to exist. Sari Nusseibeh, when did you start to feel that you were ready to recognize Israel's right to exist?
Well, to tell you, I think it was in the 80s, that's to say within the last 10 years. My personal preference has really always been to go for a binational state, in which Palestinians and Israelis or Jews would share in the political system, in the same political system, would share in the same government, would have equal votes, equal rights in the entire country that is called Palestine or Israel. But I discovered, I think in the 80s, that on the one hand, the Palestinians themselves wanted to be distinct, to be separate from the Israelis, and also, the Israelis, I discovered, were very opposed to the idea of merging their structure with that of the Arabs. In other words, The Israelis wanted a predominantly Jewish state, and therefore they wanted themselves to be separate from the Palestinians. And so it seemed to me that the only way to go about doing things is, which things that are less than ideal, is to address the two peoples by allowing them to have their national self-expression, each separately within their own state. And hopefully, I still look forward to a future when, having satisfied their national aspirations and feelings and hopes, that the peoples on both sides will be free of, at one point or another, free of the need to express themselves nationally. In other words, that the time would come in the future when people would overcome the national barriers and would somehow or another live in open structures.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Palestinian nationalist Sari Nusseibeh and Israeli political scientist Mark Heller. They've co-written a blueprint for a Middle East settlement called No Trumpets, No Drums, a two-state settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Sari Nusseibeh and Mark Heller. Nusseibeh is a leader in the Palestinian nationalist movement. He directs a research center in East Jerusalem and is a university lecturer in philosophy. Mark Heller is a professor at Tel Aviv University, and he's the author of several books on the Middle East. Heller and Nusseibeh have written a proposal for a two-state settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Do you feel that you got any new insights by working together about what holds up any kind of real peace between Israel and the Arabs or Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, on my part, I think my main, I think the main, maybe the main bit of new knowledge that I got from discussing the project with Mark has been to appreciate the security item in his argument. In other words, I've always, as a Palestinian, heard about the security argument, the Israeli security argument, but it was never really very convincing. It always seemed to me that the Israelis were using it as an excuse rather than as a proper argument for continuing to rule over the territories. And I was never really convinced until I started working on this project. And then I found out that, it is possible that there is some basis for the argument. And I found out also that from my point of view, it is possible to accommodate myself as a Palestinian to this concern.
Mark, do you want to say anything?
Well, I'm not sure I can say I learned something that I didn't cognitively know before, but it certainly reinforced. The exercise reinforced my belief that it is possible if people are, not even so much a question of goodwill. I think if people are rational enough and reasonable enough to think calmly about their own requirements and their self-interest, and then discuss these in a reasonable fashion, that they can reach some kind of minimally acceptable accommodation or agreement for both sides. And that's why I think it's important that we get this message out.
Let me ask you. I think you completed the book before the war, is that right? That you completed the writing of it before the war in the Gulf?
Yes, that's right, yes.
And shortly after the war in the Gulf started, Sari Nusseibeh, you were detained by the Israeli police and you were held for, was it 3 months?
3 months, that's right.
And
it was 6 months, but then it was reduced by 3 months.
And you were accused of giving information to the Palestinians about where Scud missiles had landed in Israel?
I was accused of being an Iraqi spy, a Scud specialist, by the Israelis. But this was a media accusation. It wasn't really a proper accusation.
You weren't formally charged?
No. It was a media accusation. And in any case, they didn't need to charge me. They used the British mandatory laws to put me under administrative detention for, they wanted it to be for 6 months, but then it was reduced to 3 months.
I know you've denied that you did any of the things that you felt you were detained for. What was your response to being detained shortly after trying to, you know, write a book about a negotiated peace?
Well, I wasn't. It didn't affect me actually, because you know I distinguish in my mind between people in the Israeli some people in the Israeli government, officials, I don't know, security services people whose job it is to put people like me in jail, and on the other hand, the Israelis in general, whose interest it is to reach to have a peace agreement with people like me. And so I didn't really feel offended. I realize, you know, that there is an occupation. The Israelis occupy the Palestinians. We're under occupation. There's a problem between us and them, and we have to pay the price. But this doesn't mean that, you know, by paying the price or through paying the price, one therefore loses sight of where one's interests lie. And I certainly didn't lose sight of where my interests lied. And in fact, when I was in jail, I think my wife brought to me one of the galley proofs to look through. So I was still working, in a sense, on the book right at the end when I was inside a small 2-meter by 3-meter cell.
What's your relationship with each other now? Now that the book is finished, you don't have to negotiate with each other anymore.
Yeah, we're thinking of going into business.
I realize you're joking, but I'm still interested in knowing if you've become friends, if you talk with each other outside of the book, if that's relevant at all to the process you were trying to work out.
The answer is, in both cases, is yes. I mean, speaking for myself, we have become friends. And it's, I mean, I don't know if it's relevant to the process in the sense that people have to be friends in order to do this, but it may become, it may be more than coincidence that they become friends after it's done.
Yeah, I think it's very important, actually, that this has happened, because it's very, in general, it's possible to reach an agreement between two people, and then you come out after you've reached the agreement feeling bitter about the other side. And, you know, you sometimes feel like this when you go into a shop and bargain for something and you buy something and you reach an agreement or you sign a contract and you come out feeling bitter. But in this case, you know, in spite of the pain that went through it, you know, on both sides, at least at the end, I think there's a feeling of, well, you know, the friendship, but more than this, the feeling that... you know, that something genuine was done, and it wasn't, we weren't trying to con each other or bluff each other, and that we're both doing something serious. I don't know.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terry Gross spoke with Sari Nesebe and Mark Heller, the authors of the new book, No Trumpets, No Drums, which is a detailed plan for a two-state solution for Israel and Palestine. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams, National Public Radio in Washington, with a word about all things considered. We'll explore the issue of sexual harassment from the legal and political perspectives. A Stanford law professor tells me that 85% of women in the workplace have been subject to harassment. Only a tiny percentage ever formally complain. Elizabeth Arnold reports from Capitol Hill on maneuvering there. The Food and Drug Administration approves DDI, a drug to help ease the symptoms of AIDS. A new study indicates that cocaine use by males could be harmful to the fetus. Also, NPR's Daniel Zwerling reports from Ethiopia. The newly independent province of Eritrea is having difficulties putting its capital city, Asmara, back together. That's later on All Things Considered.
Two new TV projects this weekend look back at earlier times, but with different methods and with different results. NBC begins a 6-hour miniseries called A Woman Named Jackie, about the life of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Showtime Cable premieres a documentary called Hearts of Darkness, about the making of Francis Ford Coppola's 1979 film Apocalypse Now. TV critic David Biancooley has these reviews.
Let's start with Hearts of Darkness and with a little piece of advice. If you have a VCR or video disc player, go out and rent a copy of Apocalypse Now for the weekend. Because as soon as you've finished watching Hearts of Darkness, you'll want to see Apocalypse all over again. Fax Barr and George Hinkenlooper wrote and directed this documentary, and they contribute a lot. They've conducted fresh interviews with many of the people involved and have gone all the way back to an Orson Welles radio play of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness to set the mood and the stage. The bulk of the material, though, comes from Eleanor Coppola, who accompanied her husband to the Philippines to head the Making of the Movie documentary unit. These days, such behind-the-scenes films are pure promotion. But with Apocalypse Now, Eleanor Coppola kept filming as the big-budget movie endured one setback after another. She kept a diary, noting the problems in the movie and in her marriage, and she filmed in the midst of natural disasters and unnatural tantrums. She even secretly taped her husband's phone conversations back to the States, in which he begged the studio not to pull the plug because he was making a masterpiece. And she also secretly taped his private conversations with her, where he was much more honest and much less sure of himself.
What I have to admit is that I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, how do you account for the discrepancy between what you feel about it and what everybody else who sees it or the other?
Because they see the magic of what has happened before. I'm saying, hey, it's not going to happen. I don't have any performances. The script doesn't make sense. I have no ending. I'm like a voice crying out, saying, please, it's not working. Somebody get me off this. And nobody listens to me. Everyone says, yes, well, Francis works best in a crisis. I'm saying this is one crisis I'm not going to pull myself out of.
Hearts of Darkness is terrific from start to finish because it's all so real and so believable. On the other hand, A Woman Named Jackie is 6 hours of drama that almost never seems real. It's got three good performances, by Stephen Collins as JFK, Joss Ackland as Aristotle Onassis, and Roma Downey as Jackie. But it's got one long, bad script. So many Kennedy-related movies and miniseries have been made that it's become a genre unto itself. And A Woman Named Jackie doesn't compare well against scenes familiar from other dramas. And certainly, when it presents new material, it's almost always questionable. Even if they come from secondhand sources, it's hard to accept as fact the content of such private conversations as Jack and Bobby Kennedy talking about Marilyn Monroe, or Jackie Kennedy picking up a private White House phone and talking to Marilyn herself.
Hello. It's okay. I'll call back. Wait a minute, Marilyn. Is that you? Are you Marilyn? Let me ask you something. What exactly are your intentions toward my husband?
Excuse me, my what?
I mean, do you really want him? Because if you do, and he really wants you, then I'll just step aside.
Gee, Mrs. Kennedy, I really don't know what to say.
And then you two can get married, and you can live in this damn White House.
I think that scene about says it all. A Woman Named Jackie, in my opinion, is a drama called Boring. But don't dare miss Hearts of Darkness. This weekend, watching a real-life documentary about a dramatic film is a lot more entertaining than watching a dramatic film about what the writers are claiming is real life.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's hard to believe, but it's been nearly 2 years now since the Berlin Wall fell. On the next edition of Fresh Air, we examine some of the unexpected and absurd changes caused by the reunification of Germany. We talk with Peter Schneider, author of the new book, The German Comedy. That and more on the next Fresh Air.